Now we're in for another treat, and that's somebody we love very much. Who knows what he's going to say? I don't know, but get ready. It's our Dave Hamill.
Ladies and gentlemen, Salvador Padilla. You know, some people would be very afraid to follow that. Not me. I'm either too dumb, but really, I think you guys are not going to be back in your right brains thinking normally for hours, so I think I'll get away with anything. Thank you, Salvador. Tonight, I want to talk about beliefs and how beliefs can shape and direct our journey in life. And as we get closer and closer to our source energy, which is what animates us, in my opinion, it's part of God. There's non-physical, and when we come here into physical, we bring part of that non-physical energy with us, and that's what leaves us when we die. It goes back over to non-physical. The closer we get aligned to that source, the more godlike and the more loving we are. And there's just no way I can sit and listen to Salvador sing and not realize that, he's connected to source energy. He's clear. He's really tuned into that. And music does that for us. It so often lifts us and brings us to new heights. And that was just amazing, just wonderful. Thank you. So in my journey, my beliefs, and in all our journeys, I think really shape what direction we go. And what is a belief? Well, belief is just a thought that we keep thinking. And we keep thinking. And we keep giving it energy. And we keep thinking it, and after a while, it's just part of our belief structure, you know, part of the rules that we operate with. And those beliefs can be very helpful to us, or they can be a hindrance to us. And you've known people that have some beliefs that you kind of wonder about, you know, I mean, and you look back through history, and you look at beliefs that people operated on, and you're kind of going like, really, garlic and vampire keeps the vampires away? So, I mean, some of them are just kind of wacky, and some of my beliefs to a lot of you would probably be a little wacky, but nevertheless, they're ones that I've grown with and brought forward into my life. When Ray talked last week, he talked about his journey, and I'd like to share a part of my journey, especially 2009. For me, it's really hard to classify. It's the old, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times, it was just a crazy year for me. And as I get further away from it and I get a little bit more perspective, I see how I think it was just divinely crafted to bring me to this point that I could really turn my life around. And when January started in 2009, I had just gotten together in a relationship. We'd gotten together, she'd come from across the country to be with me. And it was the most amazing love relationship I've ever been in. And I had asked God before, I said, God, I want to be unconditional in my loving. And God said, okay. I'm going to step up to the plate. Be ready. And it was amazing for me because I got to love on a level that I had never even approached before. And I was as unconditional as I could be. The problem being is that I focused it all on her and didn't keep any from me. And when you love like that, it's not really true love. It's not this love source connection that I'm talking about that comes from us, because until we give that and have that for ourselves, we really can't share it with anyone. But nevertheless, it was magnificent for me. It opened new horizons for me. And when that relationship ended in June, that structure that I had built around her was gone. And I looked at myself and I had no structure to support me. And I felt I tortured myself for a long time. In April, actually this week a year ago, I was lying in a bed over at UCSD Hospital. A number of you guys came and visited me, bless your hearts. And I had a car that fell off a jack and landed on my right leg, crushed, fractured both bones in my leg. And fortunately, my neighbor was there, got me out from underneath this car in about 45 seconds. We're half a block from the paramedics. They came, zipped me over to the hospital, and in no time, I was in the emergency room. I've never been in that kind of pain in my life. Bones don't like to be changed from the way they are. They're not happy campers that way. And so I spent a week. They put one of those external frames where they drill all kind of things in your leg and stabilize it. But for that week, every 2 hours, I was getting either an IV narcotic or a pill. And when I went to sleep the first night, I slept past the pain med, and when I woke up, I was again in tremendous pain. So I just told the nursing staff every night, wake me up, and whatever pain level I have to tell you I have, that's what I have, because I'm not going through this. And it was so bad, I couldn't sit in bed. I was writhing around, and it was just horrible pain. So for a week, I was on these strong narcotics. I had a surgery to put plates in my leg, and my surgeon, bless her heart, was fabulous. The team was fabulous. Everything was wonderful. And the funny thing was, she said, you broke that leg, didn't you? And I went, I broke one of my legs when I was in high school. And she said, that was that leg. She said, there was a bone spur that grew from your fibula to your tibia, the two bones down there, and it connected the two together. When you cracked, when the car fell on your leg, it broke that. But there was a little piece on there, and when we started to put the screws and plates and bring everything back together, we could tell where it was supposed to go because of that little bone spur that had been there since I was 19 years old. So, or actually 17 years old. So it was funny, that happens way back then, it helps to benefit me now. So I got out of the hospital, I spent about 6 weeks taking more drugs because it was killing me, and that whole time, I think it really started, all the narcotics started to tamp me down, start pushing me down and depress me, because that's what they're designed to do. And the relationship ended. That was another blow. And I didn't walk for 3 months. I was on crutches for 3 months, and I'd come in here, and the congregation was always wonderful. Laura Kennedy would come over with an extra chair for me so I could sit on the end and put my leg up, and many of you helped me, and George helped me carry groceries out to the car, and I couldn't do anything by myself. And it really made me see what a blessing people are in your life. Because I didn't want to have the help, but I knew I had it. And I had to stop and look at it and see, you know, when I allow others to help me, it's a blessing for both of us. And I was blessed by a lot of caring people that were wonderful. As I went through the summer, it was the end of July before I got off the crutches and started walking again. And when I did, it was very difficult. I wasn't very strong, and I live on a boat. And when the boat rocks, it was kind of great exercise, but my leg still isn't quite back. It's not that strong yet, but it's getting pretty close. And that disability just really affected who I am. It's hard to be yourself when you're not feeling right, when you can't do the things you're used to doing, plus all the other things that had happened. And then in October, I'd finally got strong enough to do a fishing cruise. And we went out, and we had another one booked, and we had a cruise, and we're coming back about 15 miles offshore. We blew up one of the transmissions and had to come back on one engine, and we were expecting to get these people back at 5:30, and by the time we got them back, I had to be towed the last mile because we had a big tide coming out of the harbor, and we couldn't get back in. We could only go in one direction, and the tide kept pushing us over to the rocks. So we ended up getting towed back in about 10:30 at night before we got these guys back. And we worked our fannies off trying to get this transmission replaced so we could get the next one the next week. And there was a problem with the transmission after we got it installed. It was defective. So another big blow. We just killed ourselves trying to get this thing going. And then about 2 weeks later, a friend of mine adopted a dog. And so I went over to see the dog. And it turned out to be a 3-year-old German Shepherd. And she wasn't really a dog person. And I love dogs. I've been around dogs all my life. And I went over to her house, and she was sitting on her sectional, and the dog was sitting on her lap. And I came in and sat down next to her, and we started talking. And the dog heard my voice and looked up at me. And he wasn't acting weird, so I just reached over and petted him on the head, and he was fine. And then he started crawling on his forelegs, and I thought, oh, he wants another pet. And I went to lean down to pet him again, and he attacked me and bit me above the eye and almost knocked me out. And the dog was going, and all I could do was go in a fetal position, and thank God she was there to grab this dog, because he was just snarling and going absolutely crazy, berserk, growling, barking, just scared me to death. And from that experience of feeling so powerless and knowing that if she hadn't been there, I would have been mauled, I ended up getting post-traumatic stress disorder from that. And so that's October. Go forward a couple of months and January, and so let me get into my beliefs about this so you'll see where I'm trying to go with this. my belief was, and I was raised in a family where if you were going to get love and affection in the beginning, it was you had to be a good boy, or my sister had to be a good girl. And so as a child, I kept finally figured out that if I was being myself, the real Dave, I wasn't going to get any love and affection because that was the bad kid. Don't be a bad boy. Bad boy, you know, good boys don't do that. And so the only way I got that love and affection was to be this good kid who wasn't who I was. So I extrapolate out and go, well, I must be a bad kid. And I must not be lovable because I can't get loved if I'm me. And before I got, I don't know, a few, probably junior high school or something, I think my mom realized that, and it was just overboard with love and hugs, and I couldn't get out the door. But, you know, it was like too late because I knew that I still wasn't, you know, if I wasn't getting the love for who I am, and I'm just getting love anyway, well, that doesn't count either. And it becomes part of our operating system. As, you know, we make these decisions, we forget about them, but they really start steering our life. So that belief that I was unlovable and that I wasn't worthy started steering my belief, you know, started steering me in this direction. And I never saw this depression coming on. It moves at like glacial speed. And there aren't any big red flags or things that go on or happen so that you know that you're getting depressed. But as the summer wore on, the fall wore on, came to January, I was severely depressed. And I was talking to George one night, and George said, do you think you're depressed? And at that moment, because in depression, you're kind of doing this. You go up and down and things, and I went, nah, I don't think so. I think I'm pretty good. Why? And he goes, well, no, you know, I just thought I'd throw it out there. And so we talked a little bit more. I was like, huh. But he planted that seed. And I got off the phone with him, and I thought, you know what? I'm going to call my sister. And my sister's an RN and very bright gal. And we talked, and she said, you know, when Mom passed in 2005, I went through a stage of depression. And because I was really leery about antidepressants. And she said, you know, what they did for me was just give me some resiliency. And I was like, okay, well, maybe I'll try it. So the next day, I thought, you know, I'm going to go up to the VA and talk to somebody. And what had happened in the meantime through this period was that my beliefs that I was not a good kid, and the other one my mom had was bad things happen to bad people, good things happen to good people. And if you had negative emotions, we didn't validate that. We're not talking, that's not right. You know, that's not happening. And so through this whole thing, my thought pattern started getting darker and darker. This depression rose and rose, and I kept thinking, you know, what's wrong with me? What's going on? Why is this happening to me? Oh, there's something wrong with me. I'm a bad kid. And it started spiraling and getting tighter and happening more often, and kept spiraling and getting larger and larger in my head. And as this was going on, I was isolating from people. I'd spend, except when I was coming to church or class, Millie's class, I'd be on the boat by myself a lot. And these thoughts kept getting stronger and stronger because those were my beliefs. And those beliefs kept driving me, driving me, driving me. And it kept driving me so hard that finally that day, after I talked to George and my sister, I realized that I needed to get some help because I thought rationally, as a rational human being, if this pain is this bad, then I don't want to continue with this. I'm going to end this. I don't want to keep going on with this. What's funny is I look back now and I actually said, rational, this is a rational answer, you know, from an irrational mind because I was so messed up. But at that point, you know, it sounded like, oh, that's, you know, I'm not going to put up with this pain anymore. This is what life's about. And so I went up to the VA, told them my story and to a social worker, and she said, okay, let me have you talk to one of the psychiatrists. And took me over to this other spot, and I talked to the psychiatrist and told her the whole story about the dog and everything, and I'm having a breakdown every time I talk about the dog. And she said, what are you doing for the rest of the afternoon? And I said, well, nothing. I have, you know, I cleared my book so I could be here. And she said, oh, good, we're going to admit you. And I'm like, oh, really? Tell a psychiatrist you're going to kill yourself. Yes, they're going to admit you. So we go through all this stuff, and they finally take me over to the locked psych ward. I'm going like, oh, really? So we go on the psych ward, and it was just sort of what you think if you ever saw One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest way back when. I mean, there are some people who are really gorked out there and on some really heavy medications. And I'm kind of going like, oh, where am I now? And this again now starts shattering my facade, my pretensions about who Dave is. And I had to, they gave me a gown in the ward clerk said, you have to get undressed, put the gown on so we can check and make sure you don't have any lesions on your skin. I'm like, okay. So I do that. She said, okay, you can get dressed now. And so I'm getting dressed. She goes, oh, by the way, she said, I'll need your belt and your take your shoelaces out of your shoes. And if that wasn't one of the most humbling things that's ever happened to me, I don't know what it is, because the rest of my facade pretensions just went poof. Oh, I can't be trusted to have shoelaces? Oh, good. So I spent a week there. The people are wonderful. They absolutely do a beautiful job. And it was a week I needed to get on medication. And I got on medication for my PTSD, which has gotten a lot better, and the depression has gotten a lot better. But it's, and I said, you know, this is a better living through chemistry program. This is wonderful. I like this. And after I got out, I went back to my boat, and a number of you guys came and visited me in the hospital, which, you know, it's a real slice of life. By that time, I was on the better ward. I only stayed for a little bit on that ward. And when I got back there, I had time to really sit and look at my beliefs and how I got to where I was. And I realized that my beliefs really weren't serving me, that they were pushing me into where I've been. And I thought, well, that's, you know, what's going on here? And with now some time, some distance to step back and look at it, I realized that I crafted this whole thing, not consciously, but I really think on a soul level, it was time that my soul said, you know, enough. Wake up. And as these things happened, it was like, you awake now? Nah. Not looking at that. Nope. Okay. Something else. The relationship ended. I had the accident. The relationship ended. Are you awake yet? No. Mm-mm. Not ready. The dog attack, all this stuff. And finally, it was like I deconstructed Dave down to the point there was nothing left. There was no facade, no pretensions, nothing left to hide behind or hang my hat on. And I had to face myself. And at that point, I was scared to death. And I looked at myself, because I'd never felt worthy, and I'd never felt lovable. And I had to look at myself, and through the grace of God, I found that I was worthy. And I realized that I am a soul that God created, and that's enough. All the rest of my story is just a bunch of baloney. It's this ego that thinks that, oh, here, let's play some more games. But I really got clear that all these ego beliefs had driven me to this point, but I think I was really kind of just being nudged along by my higher self, my inner being, whatever you want to call it, so that I could find myself again. And in that moment of finding myself and finding myself worthy, I got the first little dribble of self-love. And what was beautiful is that at that point, it felt like a sponge just soaking it up. It was so wonderful. It was just so uplifting for me. And the way I got there was by going back and looking at that love that I had in the relationship. Because I said, what does that love really look like? Well, in that relationship, I was loving at such a high level, and it felt so great. I could go back there in a second and feel great. And I said, can I do this for myself? I've never done it. I've never had it for myself. And in that moment, I could transfer that feeling to myself. So that love that I had before came back to help me and to help me start filling myself up. And it's now part of my regular practice to be filling myself up and to feeling good. And so I see all this trail that I took through the last year was just divinely designed to bring me back. And I don't know what the psychiatrist would say today, but I can tell you I'm feeling a heck of a lot better than I have in years. I mean, even before the depression. Because now I'm connected back to Source. And I realize that if I'm in here connecting to Source and that good feeling, then I feel great. How could you not if we're connected to that God Source, that God that's inside us? And so now my walk is to be present as much as I can, and I'm trying to be present every step of my journey. Because when I feel great, then it reinforces, yes, this is what you're doing. You're connected to Source. You're aligned with Source in here. And when I start feeling bad, it's source's way of telling us you're not going in the right direction. I love what Abraham says about it. They say, when you have desires, you shoot off these desires. They shoots off rockets of desire, and your larger non-physical self aligns with that and moves and becomes that. And when you are aligned with that desire and you're moving towards that, it feels good, because that's our relationship with our non-physical self. If that's emotions, that is our non-physical self saying, yeah, 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 good, keep coming, keep coming, keep coming. And when it starts feeling awful, we're not aligned with that. We're not keeping up with who we've become. We've expanded in non-physical. We now are not keeping up with it, and we're getting bad feelings. And so when I get a bad feeling, and in our family, you didn't have bad feelings were not okay. So now I got to see bad feelings are okay. They really have a purpose. They really help guide us if we'll pay attention to them. And so now when I get a bad feeling, I stop and I go, what's going on here? And I start in trying to reconnect. And if I have trouble reconnecting, I have to look at that. Again, some of my beliefs come up. Now I used to be here. Here's worthy. Here's unworthy. And now I'm coming up higher. I'm not totally worthy because there's still some things that I'm working on, and finances being one of them. And how much do I deserve to have? Well, when I get aligned with source again, then I realize that I can have whatever I want, that I am worthy. We are all worthy. But the ego just goes, nah, let's slow down a little bit, pal. You're not that good. So there's two games that I've learned that I'm going to share with you before I end. And they're really kind of fun games to, if you're having financial prosperity issues or think we could all have more. And one of them is called the $100 bill game. And you either put a $100 bill in your pocket, or at least think you have $100, or write yourself a note for $100 and put it in there. And then when you go throughout your day, spend it over and over and over. And if you see something that costs $300, spend your $100 bill 3 times. And because our unconscious, or subconscious rather, doesn't know what's real and what isn't real. That's why when you say, or you start thinking, I want no more drama in my life, all your unconscious hears is drama. So you can go spend this money, and it doesn't know that it's not real. And as you start spending it, it starts going, oh, this is feeling better, this is feeling better, and it starts dropping those defenses down. So that's a fun, and it reminds me of a Twilight Zone from years ago. And those of you who are old enough that saw those shows, there was a guy who was walking along the street, and he happened to look down and saw a wallet on the ground. So he bent down and picked it up, and he looked at it, and it was this scruffy thing, and he looked, and there was no identification in it, and he was just getting ready to throw it away, and he stopped, and he opened it up, and there was a $20 bill in there. And he thought, oh, great, well, there's no name, nobody knows who this is. So he pulls a $20 bill out, and he goes, all right, great. And he got ready to throw it away again, and he opened it up, and there was another $20 bill. And he went, nah. Took the other $20 out, and he looked, there's nothing in it, and he closed it up and went, another $20 bill. And every time he took a $20 bill out of there, another $20 bill showed up. So it was that kind of thing. The story ended with him buying all kinds of stuff. He went and this was in the 50s or 60s, went in and bought a car with $20 bills and things, and was buying everything. Life was great. And he was out having dinner, and he was walking out of the restaurant afterwards, and a thief came up, stuck a gun in his ribs, said, give me your wallet. And he went, I'll give you all the money I have. The guy goes, give me your wallet, give me your wallet. He says, no, I'll give you the money. He goes, no. And he finally got tired, so he hits the guy over the head, takes his wallet, reaches in there, runs down the alley, reaches in there, sees a $20 bill, takes it, throws it in a dumpster, and runs off. That was the end of the story. Yeah. The other game that's really fun is called the $1,000 a day game. And this one I did, if anybody does spreadsheets like using Excel, it's really easy, or you can just do it on a sheet of paper. So for 1 year, you start on day one with $1,000. And you write down what you're going to spend that $1,000 on, and you have to spend the entire amount each day. Okay? So you write down what you're going to spend your $1,000 on. Day two, you have $2,000. Do the same thing, spend it. Again, your subconscious doesn't know that this isn't real. Day three, you have $3,000. And you do that until the last day of the year, you have $365,000 to spend. Now, being on Excel, I use the add it all up. And for 1 year, if you do this, you'll spend $66,795,000. And you talk about really priming the pump and getting things going. It's really fun to do, and you could pay back debts, and you could go buy things that you, because it gets you out of your everyday space to where you are, and it puts you out there going like, you know, I could do this with the Learjet, would be really cool, or, you know, and the home on the beach in Hawaii, or wherever you want to be, and it's just a really great thing to sort of get you out of where you are and get back to feeling the way that we should. So my journey is coming. Who knows what next year will be like, but this 2009 was really a blessing in disguise in a lot of ways. And I'm really excited to see what 2010 is, and I tell you, I'm feeling better than I have in a long time, and I thank all of you for your love and support. Thank you.